It's Wednesday. It's 1 o'clock. It's time for the Indie Media Radio London show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4, bringing protest stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and to global indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk. Happy New Year from the Indie Media crew. And yes, we have a crew. We have FDP in the studio and we have the amazing, delectable Kate, who's going to give us an update on the Broadway market situation, 34 Broadway Market, which has featured on the show. Go for it.
The Broadway Market Occupiers Update, 3rd of January 2006. There was more media coverage of the community occupation in defence of Tony's Cafe today. ITV London Tonight, The Evening Standard again, RAI Italian National TV News, and forthcoming The Hackney Gazette and The Guardian. Re-eviction is imminent, however, so if you can make it down here to show your support any time after 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, we'd appreciate it. It's not 100% it will happen tomorrow, but the bailiffs have their orders now. If you can make it, please come down. TV crews will be there from RAI and the BBC, as well as filmmakers and other journalists. We will call the health and safety executive as soon as there's any sign of demolition commencing. Though perhaps this time Rattan will show his employers, passers-by, and his tenants in the neighbouring flats the basic courtesy of following a few safety procedures. If not, the HSE will be informed immediately. Public meeting, 16th of January, 7 p.m. St. Mark. A public meeting will take place on January the 16th at 7 p.m. in St. Mark Church Hall, Lansdowne Drive, E8. The meeting will go ahead even if the current occupiers of Tony's Cafe are evicted before this date. We are expecting Deputy Mayor Jessica Crowe from Hackney Council to be present. Mayor of Hackney, Jules Pipes, and Dr. Roger Rattan, current owner of 34 Broadway Market, have also been invited. Yesterday, January 3rd, Spirit of Nutrition's Food Gallery, 71 Broadway Market, received an eviction notice for January 20th. It is more important than ever to come and tell the council what you think about the sell-offs in Broadway Market and the rest of Hackney. Come and have your say. See you on the 16th.
In St. Mark's. Okay, now we're going to go to some Jimmy Cliff with Suffering in the Land.
Situation. the Christian Peace.
212. Yeah, this is Michael Franti here from Spearhead, and you're listening to Indie Media's London Radio, connecting London with the rest of the planet. Stand firm, stay human, hold the vibes, and give the corporation some complications.
Hello, welcome back. We're now in the studio with Robin Horsell, who was one of the peace activists who we featured on the show in the last couple of weeks that went to Palestine to try and attend the non-violent conference held in the city of Bethlehem. We also have in the studio his daughter Kate, who you just heard reading the news about 34 Broadway Market. So, welcome back from your sojourn in the detention centre.
Thank you very much.
What do you think about the whole situation?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I went there. I tried to challenge the right of the Israelis to control who can be friends with the Palestinians and who can't. The judge's decision at the end of the day was that the Minister of the Interior has discretion and the court isn't going to interfere with that, even if there's no reason to stop someone coming in.
So they turned you away. I understand it was on the basis of information supplied by the British security services.
He mentioned that there had been information from the British state, yes. But having read the judgment now, there was nothing conclusive in there that you could look at and say, well, these people are a danger or a threat to the state of Israel, which was the grounds that they denied us entry on.
And there's no system for appeal once you've left.
Well, we did have leave to appeal to the Supreme Court, but it wouldn't have come up before the end of the conference, and it was the conference that I went there for this time. So,
And what did you think about your dad being away over Christmas, Kate?
I didn't mind because I knew he was going there for a good reason.
We've got squeaky mic stands in the studio. So did you miss him?
No, because I was with my mum's family.
So what do you think about, why do you think it's a good reason for Robin to go to Palestine?
Because he's trying to, like, see the Palestinians. He's not doing anything bad, so it must be a good thing.
And when you were in the detention centre, how did you get treated?
Well, I mean, on the whole, the treatment was okay. There was one particularly violent incident where my cellmate got beaten up, which was unpleasant. The food was pretty horrible. But the whole time that I was in there, I was aware that there are hundreds or thousands of Palestinians at any time who are detained in much worse circumstances, who have no right of appeal, who, you know, under what is called administrative detention, in which in apartheid South Africa would have been called detention without trial. People can just be snatched and caged in the most horrible situation. So I was aware throughout the time that really I was quite privileged.
So what happened when your cellmate was beaten up?
Well, they told me that I was going to be flying, and I told them that I wasn't because I was waiting for the court hearing to come up. And they came into the cell. I was wearing my boxer shirts, shorts and my T-shirt, so it wasn't going to be that easy for them to put me on a plane. They started grabbing my arm. My cellmate linked arms with me. And they just went wild. They jumped him, really. I just sat there thinking, well, my plane's going, but they're doing really terrible things to my cellmate. So it was pretty unpleasant.
Did he have to go to hospital?
He was hospitalised overnight and then came back and he was put in isolation for a week.
And because he was also one of the other peace activists from Italy.
He was, yeah.
And he was trying to attend the non-violence conference as well. So why do you think they beat him so hard?
Well, I mean, they obviously didn't like the fact that he was supporting a cellmate. That seemed to be a great problem for them. But I think it also, you know, that quite often you do see that the response to non-violent action is violent action, and they certainly managed to show that that was their only response to it this time.
And we've got, there's other, some British activists were allowed to attend the conference. Do you know why some were let in and some were not?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's all very arbitrary and it's very strange. But I think one of the positive things about the ruling we got in court was that once again it was confirmed that ISM is not illegal and it's not enough just to stop someone because they say that they're going out with ISM. So this is people's opportunity to go out there and test that for themselves.
So people could... Because the whole issue is that people have to say they're going to Israel to be on holiday and they're going there for other reasons other than to visit Palestinians.
That's right. I mean, basically, people have most chance of getting in if they play the innocent tourist. And people who've been once or more quite often will change their names because that's the only way of getting back in. It shouldn't have to be like that. You know, we should be free to have Palestinian friends. We should be free to go and see them when we want to.
Are Palestinians controlling the borders now from Egypt to Gaza?
Well, they have some control, but it's very much supervised by the Israelis who have CCTV cameras that are watching everything that's going on. And the Palestinians themselves are being monitored by a team of monitors from the European Union. So in no way, I think, can it be said that they're an independent state who've got control of their own borders or, in fact, of their own economy or anything else.
And have all the peace activists now been deported?
As far as I know, there was still one person who was waiting to go to court and it was unclear as to whether she was going to do that because the hearing was already over. And of course there's Andrew Munsey, who was detained well before Christmas, who's been there for a long time. And he's someone who's been out there for some months working with ISM, and he's very much resisting they're wanting to deport him without any reason, really. I mean, they're not charging him with anything. They're not accusing him of breaking any laws. They're just trying to deport him, and he's resisting that.
So, but he actually was allowed into the country. The difference between Andrew Munsey's case and your case is that you were not allowed in. You were not processed into the country. You were immediately rejected, whereas Andrew had been allowed in, and so he is now subject to certain Israeli laws and he's refusing to be deported, so they're saying that's okay, we can keep you here indefinitely.
Yeah, I mean, it was different. The only thing I would say is that Andrew changed his name to get back in. He'd been before and he went back as Andrew MacDonald and he got in. I wasn't prepared to change my name because I think it is time for us to be open and transparent about what we're doing. You know, we do support the Palestinians. There's a growing number of us and we're going to keep challenging it. You know, in the end, I believe Palestinians will be free. They cannot be kept in this condition, in this situation forever. It's impossible.
Okay, thank you very much.
Every day I wake, I feel like crying. Every second I feel like praying. Everywhere I turn, my people dying. Brothers and sisters, now listen to what I'm saying. I don't really feel like writing, and I don't really feel like singing. Cause everywhere I look, my people fighting, and it's our own that we're killing. The same gunmen that cry about suppression of the white man and his racist oppression. Go to church and give God his confession. Gun in iron pocket and a crack in his possession. Damn hypocrite, don't be disillusioned. Yeah, life is tough, but that's not a solution. You go out like you're brave, that's an illusion. Brave men wouldn't kill us, almost start a revolution. Gunmen and too much. Drug man, what are we showing the youth? Them we should be protecting, instead we're destroying. Oh Father, watch over them.
Okay, more from Palestine. Palestine-Israel, the joint struggle at Bilin intensifies. This outpost was built on the lands of Bilin on the west side of the separation fence, or the apartheid wall, adjacent to the illegal building site of the settlement town Modin Elit on the robbed lands of Bilin. It existed for a day and a half. The outpost was named the Bilin Centre for the Joint Struggle for Peace and received a lot of media attention in Israel. During its short existence till it was destroyed, it was held mainly by activists and Bilin and Israelis of Anarchists Against the Wall initiative. A nice surprise was the friendly visit of five Orthodox Jews from the already inhabited area of the settlement. On the evening of Thursday, the 23rd of December, the armed forces of Israel brought to the outpost about 150 police, soldiers and fire brigade personnel. They entered the big metal container which was being used as the outpost centre. After detaining the people, they confiscated it and took it away. The outpost, which was built on the lands of Bilin on the west side of the wall adjacent to the illegal settlement town of Modin Elit, on Thursday, most of the activists involved were released immediately except seven of the Israelis who were among the people in the outpost structure or on its roof, who were taken to the Shivat Ziv police station. When it was announced in Bilin that the outpost was destroyed, a few hundred people marched towards the wall and confronted the Israeli armed forces there, who dispersed the demonstrators with tear gas grenades. A few hours later, the seven Israelis were released, though they refused to sign a bail with the usual condition that they will not return to Bilin for 2 weeks. The usual Friday demonstration was held as usual. The theme of this demonstration was similar to the one of the previous week, again trying to campaign against the illegal building of a settlement on the lands robbed from the Bilin villagers. At the front of the demonstration, people held a big free languages banner. This is an illegal construction. As usual, the armed state forces blocked the way of the protesters about 50 metres from the route of the fence, and they pushed people brutally but could not prevent them from constructing a big tent on the side of the road. This tent was announced as a replacement to the Centre for Joint Struggle for Peace, which was destroyed the evening before on the other side of the fence. And as usual, participants of the demonstration tried to reach the route of the fence through the olive orchards on the side of the road, and the armed forces, of course, pushed people back, shoved them, and read loudly the usual document which declares the region is closed for Israelis and is a closed military zone. And as usual, no one took it seriously. Not even when the level of brutality escalated and four of the protesters were injured and needed treatment. And as usual, not far from the non-violent demonstration, youngsters confronted the soldiers, who responded by shooting them with tear gas canisters. During the non-violent demonstration and the violent actions of the state forces, two Israelis and one Palestinian was detained. The Israelis were released on the spot at the end of the demonstration, while the Palestinian comrade was taken to Givat Ziv police station with the intention to relocate him to the Ofa concentration camp. After 3 hours of verbal and physical confrontation with the armed forces and frequent raining, it was announced that the demonstration was ended, but the big tent that was declared as a replacement for the Centre for the Joint Struggle for Peace was destroyed. Where the protesters clashed, they were trying to argue that if settlements can put illegal structures there, so could Palestinians. We're going to go to another track now.
Le mie alor risolate stamattina, come te pozzo amar, come te pozzo amar. Se esco di sti cancelli qualcuno l'ha da pagare. Amore, amore, mandami un saluto. E so regina c'è l'incarcerato, da amici e da parenti abbandonato, so come un povero albero sparuto, come te pozzo amar, come te pozzo amar. Esco di sti cancelli, qualcuno l'ha da pagare. A tocchi,
campana sonà. I turchi sono arrivati alla marina. Viva i montisciani e viva Roma. Viva la gioventù triste e verina.
Okay, so just going back to that last story for a moment, I think it's worth noting that in the week that the Israelis destroyed that structure, which was put up by the Israeli protesters against the wall, at least 18 illegal outposts were opened by Zionist groups, and they haven't been got rid of, despite the fact that there's a clear requirements in the so-called roadmap to peace in the Middle East that illegal settlements should be dismantled. So we can see that at the end of the day, the forces are marshalled for people who oppose the apartheid war, but for people who want to increase and expand Zionist settlements, there's no problem. They're allowed to stay there.
So that also it includes also Israelis. I mean, it was an Israeli organised peace demonstration. There are Israelis who are reacting against the wall and the theft of Palestinian lands.
Indeed, there are, and they're having quite a hard time. And, you know, one of the effects of excluding activists from the West from going there is that that also brings about isolation for the small number of Israeli activists who are very committed to seeing peace and justice for Palestinians.
Okay, and now we're moving on to a story which is posted by CKUT Radio and the celebration of Haiti's independence. Exactly 202 years, one day after the slaves of the colony of Hispaniola in Haiti succeeded in overflowing their French masters and colonizers, leading to the birth of the Republic of Haiti. About 45 members of the Haitian community gathered in the Villeray area of Montreal to celebrate, but also to vent their rage. The celebration was, of course, Haiti's Independence Day, and observed on January the 1st every year. And this occasion was marched in Montreal with a festive atmosphere, upbeat Haitian compa music, and dancing in the cold and icy streets. However, the gathering was also fueled with anger as the crowd assembled outside the riding office of Pierre Pettigrew, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister. It is safe to say that Pettigrew could easily be one of the most detested figures among the Haitian community these days. Pettigrew has overseen an abhorrent Canadian presence in Haiti in the aftermath of the 2004 coup, which ousted democratically elected leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Thousands of Haitians have been killed since this coup, and these victims are more often than not targeted for their affiliation to Aristide's Lavalas movement, according to Amnesty International. However, when Pettigrew was questioned in 2005 about a University of Miami human rights investigation in Haiti, which brought these points to light, he dismissed this as propaganda, which is completely uninteresting. He preferred instead to gloss over the matter and talk abstractedly about the wonderful role Canada is playing in bringing democracy to the poor Caribbean nation. Amidst the jubilant flag waving, there was also marked anger in the air, cries of Pettigrew assassin and stop the genocide in Cite Soleil, stop the genocide in Bel Air, freedom for Haiti could be heard throughout the neighbourhood with a large immigrant and Haitian population. Many people spoke passionately in French and Creole about the pitiful role that Canada is playing, sending RCMP officers to train the brutal Haitian National Police and offering their support for an election protest that may have been denounced as sham selections. As one speaker put it more bluntly, Canada is colonizing Haiti. Attention was largely focused on the Canadian media and the role they play in the coup, as video footage was shown from Kevin Pena's film, Haiti, The Untold Story. Speakers declared that their media outlets, who didn't show these images of Haitians being killed by the HMP and the UN, were complicit in the coup and propagated racism. Food staples such as rice and beans were also piled up in front of Pettigrew's office door, with a note demanding that he deliver the food to the disadvantaged communities. Chavannes Clavel, a local Haitian musician and one of the organisers of the demonstration, explains, "As our brothers and sisters are picking through garbage for food, Canada is participating in massacres." Amongst the demands the demonstrators were making for an immediate repatriation of all Canadian forces currently in Haiti and for a public investigation into the genocide perpetrated in Haiti between February 2004 and December 2005. If this investigation isn't launched by January the 15th, the community is ready to follow up with action. As the presidential elections were delayed in Haiti again, Haitians in Canada are determined to take advantage of our own elections to put some heat on the rulers. Perhaps given Pettigrew's role in the Haitian crisis, he chose a bad riding to run in. Villeray is now riddled with posters which declare Pettigrew wanted for war crimes in Haiti. The postering campaign was initiated by the Haiti Action Montreal, and many activists were determined to bring down Pettigrew in the upcoming federal elections on January the 24th. For more information on Haiti Action, visit www.outofhaiti.ca. And that report was posted by Aaron Lakoff, who's an activist and independent journalist with CKUT Community Radio in Montreal. And he can be reached at aaron@resist.electronic-iraq.
Partire, partirò, partir bisogna.
"Where are you going?" said the man at his desk. "Oh, I'm going to a new world," said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. "I'm going to a new world," said the child, and he stood. The man at his desk,
"Oh, I will not fight your war,"
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
"Oh, I will not fight your war,"
said the child. Said the man at his desk,
"Yes, I do, but you don't,"
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
"I do, but you don't,"
said the child, and he stood.
"Don't you know the truth?"
said the man at his desk. The child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. "You lie and call it truth," said the child, and he stood.
"Oh, you must be scared to die,"
said the man at his desk. "No, I'm prepared. You're scared," said the child, and he stood.
Now we're going to play an interview recorded by Stefan Christoph for Electronic Iraq. We're going to listen to an interview with Ihab Lotayef, who travelled to Baghdad in early December as an envoy of the Canadian Islamic Congress in an effort to facilitate the release of Christian peacemaker teams, the activists who have been held hostage in Iraq since late November. Until today, the fate of the CPT activists remains unknown, as calls for the release of four anti-occupation activists, James Loney, Hamid Soudan, Tom Fox and Norman Kemba, have been echoed throughout the world. In Iraq, Lotayef's trip focused largely on addressing major media outlets in the Middle East from Baghdad and on the principled nature of the Christian Peacemaker Team's work as an organisation committed to social justice struggles internationally from Iraq. to Palestine. In this interview, Lotte F., a community activist based in Montreal, offers his perspectives on the work of the Christian Peacemaker team within the context of social movements throughout the world calling for an end to occupation in Iraq.
The Christian Peacemaker Teams is a social justice organization operating in conflict zones throughout the world, from Colombia to Palestine to Iraq. The CPT focuses on peacemaking, which emphasizes creative public witness, nonviolent direct action, and protection of human rights. In the lead up to the US-led invasion of Iraq, the CPT established a presence in Baghdad in October 2002, which continued throughout the invasion and until today under the subsequent U.S. military occupation. The CPT's work in Iraq attempts to expose abusive acts by U.S. armed forces and support Iraqis committed to nonviolent resistance against the occupation. On the 26th of November, the CPT presence in occupied Iraq was changed forever. Four members of the group were abducted. Two Canadians, James Loney, Harmeet Sudan, one American, Tom Fox, and one British citizen, Norman Kember. A previously unknown group called the Swords of Righteousness Brigade has claimed responsibility for the kidnappings and demanded that all Iraqi prisoners be released in exchange for the safe return of the four activist hostages. An original deadline was extended until December 10th, and until today, no clear word regarding the fate of the hostages is known, despite worldwide calls for their release. The CPT kidnapping in Iraq has been met with an exceptional and powerful response from the Middle East, with countless Muslim organizations and political groups calling for the immediate release of the CPT hostages, including resistance groups from the occupied territories of Palestine, where the CPT has maintained a presence in opposition to the Israeli occupation for a number of years. Major Muslim scholars from throughout the world have also denounced the kidnappings and demanded the CPT activists' release. From Canada, the Canadian Islamic Congress sent community activist Ihab Lutaif, an Egyptian-Canadian, to Iraq in early December to hold meetings with Islamic groups in Baghdad and speak publicly to the Arabic media, attesting to the nature of the CPT's anti-occupation work and the mutual trust which exists between the CPT and Muslim organizations in Canada. Lutaif's visit received international media coverage and was also covered widely inside of Iraq, where on December 9th, he held a press conference with the influential Association of Muslim Scholars, appealing for the CPT hostages' release. Shortly after Ihab returned from occupied Iraq, I had an opportunity to interview him for CKUT Radio in Montreal and the Electronic Iraq Media Project. In the interview, Ihab spoke on his experiences traveling to Iraq, representing the Canadian Islamic Congress in the context of the CPT hostage taking, which has shocked the world. Ihab describes his experiences in Iraq and how he views the work of the CPT within the larger context of movements throughout the world calling for an immediate end to the US-led military occupation of Iraq.
We have to put the whole issue in context of the chaos that's taking place in Iraq. Iraq lived through 12 years of sanctions followed by the American and Coalition of the Willing, as they call it, invasion in 2003. And till today, although we sometimes are under the pressure to be optimistic with elections widely reported, the situation in Iraq is still very grave, and people in Iraq, lots of them don't have hope. They're living in very harsh conditions, and in such a an environment, anything can happen, and any misunderstanding, misconception, or any ideology can grow without being checked with reality. And within these conditions, somebody decided that the CPT workers should be abducted and traded for, or at least that was announced, traded for the Iraqi prisoners in American and Iraqi jails. And with this in mind, we people around the world who knew about the CPT, knew about their commitment to justice and commitment to peace and commitment to supporting the weak and supporting people facing injustice anywhere in the world, being it the Middle East or being it here in Canada, because they have also lots of activities in trying to support people under the security certificate, for example, held without trial here in Canada, always demonstrate against the militarization of Canada and the American military hegemony that's trying to take over the world. When we heard, and when I say we here, I'm talking about all the organizations that I'm affiliated with in one way or another, whether they be Muslim or Arab organizations or be activist organizations in general, heard about this, the first thing we wanted to say very clearly is that these people are working for the Iraqi people in the case of Iraq, and there is no reason whatsoever to think of them as spies. There is no reason whatsoever to think of them as evangelists going there to change people's religion. They are there to support the people, both in humanitarian way and also in an anti-occupation way and also in an anti-police state way, because the CPT actually was one of the first organizations to stand in front of the Abu Ghraib, famous now Abu Ghraib jail, before it became famous in the outskirts of Baghdad, and demonstrate there and try to gather information through talking to family relatives about their loved ones that are missing and all that stuff. So we tried to say this very clearly, as you mentioned, there was an outpour of statements of support and statements of condemnation of the abduction of the CPT workers. But at a certain point, it was probably 7 days into the ordeal, I was in contact with a few Muslim organizations to issue more statements, and then the idea came out that why don't you go to Baghdad and do the same thing over there. And actually, this has crossed my mind personally before this came up in verbally, but I didn't think of it as a realistic thing, or maybe I didn't like think of it fully. So when that was said, I reflected on it again, and without a lot of hesitation, maybe without hesitation at all, I said, I'm all for it. Give me till the morning to make a final decision. And by the morning I believe it was Sunday, I had decided, yes, I'm going to go. And if I can do nothing but just state the same thing in Baghdad, in Arabic, in front of the Arabic media that would report what I'm saying, first-hand reporting, not carried through wires and through internet or whatever, then I hope that would mean something and that would help towards a positive resolution, a happy resolution of this, mm-hmm. of this conflict. And this is how it all started.
Many people across Canada saw your words on television when you were in Iraq or heard it on the radio, the efforts that you made as part of an international effort to demand the release of the CPT hostages. Could you reflect a little bit on what took place in Baghdad while you were there, and maybe talk about the reactions from people you met in Iraq to the CPT and their work? And I'd say more broadly, the presence of social justice activists in Iraq on the ground in Baghdad. How do people generally perceive activists' work there?
At a certain point when I arrived in Amman, Jordan, I wasn't even sure that I'll be able to reach Baghdad, because traveling to and from Baghdad is a very unpredictable thing. And I did not know that, for example, I needed a visa, because when I visited Iraq before 2 years ago, I went just in through the airport with my Canadian passport. But this time, the airlines would not book me a ticket to Baghdad without having an Iraqi visa, which I did not have. And then started this mission impossible to get an Iraqi visa after actually the consulate office had closed in the Iraqi embassy. And it was one of the situations where I felt that God exists, there are miracles that happen, really, because within 2 hours, facing all odds and all bureaucracy, I had the visa. And when I went back to the airline who had held a seat for me, he couldn't believe that I did have the visa. I mean, because, you know, sometimes they just send you away to an impossible thing just to get rid of you. And so anyway, I landed in Baghdad on Friday, and I had done a few contacts from Amman, Jordan, with the Association of Muslim Scholars in Iraq, for example, to hold some talks with them in a press conference. And that turned out to be, again, thank God, a very good decision to have, because it was covered widely. And as soon as we arrived to the headquarters of the Association of Muslim Scholars, there was lots of Arabic media there, and that was my goal. I mean, I wasn't there to be covered by the Western media. I was there to get my word through the Arabic media. And as soon as I saw them, I said, the whole thing is worth it. All this difficulty is worth it. Of course, I don't like to use the word success or whatever, because success is really when we get the hostages freed. And the real success is when this ugly occupation ends. And that's what the CPT workers themselves were working for. So I met with the Sheikh Abdussalam al-Qubaisi, who really turned out to be a very intelligent, visionary person. And he had already, before my arrival, spoken very strongly against the abduction of the CPT workers. Many people in Iraq who knew the work of the CPT had no doubt about the nature of their work, had no doubt about the goodwill that they were carrying towards the Iraqi people. But again, Iraq is a country where it went from only government tightly controlled media in 2003 to hundreds of newspapers coming out a day or a week in 2005. There is a lot of misinformation, a lot of lack of information, and the CPT is a small organization. It is not like Oxfam or what. It's a very small organization that many people did not hear about. And this is where the second part of my short visit to Baghdad was concentrated on. I tried to meet with key political or key community figures in Baghdad and assure them and tell them that I know CPT people personally. I know the CPT work personally. I am here talking to you as an Arab, as a Muslim, as a person who supported the Iraqi cause for years. And I assure you that those people are good people. And it was amazing how it was easy and clear to people by just stating a few facts that, yes, there is a mistake here, and we have to talk to our people in the community. We have to talk to our villages, our urban connections, our suburban connections, our rural connections, everybody. And people did that while I was sitting with them. You know, they just picked up their phones and started calling and told me, wait, don't go, you know, let me try to do what I can already. So it wasn't that complicated as soon as people know. It was the people who didn't know that were the problem. The other thing that really blew me away, and I didn't hear about it except at the evening of Friday, December 9th, that I was there, is that from Imam Al-Azam Mosque, which is one of the biggest mosques in Baghdad, a demonstration went out after Friday prayer. And I guess demonstrations going out of mosques after Friday prayer in Baghdad are not a rare occasion since the occupation. But usually it's a demonstration against the occupation or against the abduction of Iraqi people from their homes or the treatment by the Iraqi government or. This demonstration went out carrying banners saying, free our CPT friends, free the people that were helping us. And this was like shocking to me. I wouldn't expect that this would have happened. The Friday sermon itself in that mosque was centered around this issue. So adding one word to the words that are said is what I was there to do. And I tried to do it as strongly as I could.
Mm-hmm. Now, you traveled to Iraq also in 2003, and that was in the context of less than a year after the U.S.-led invasion. You were writing reports, taking photos, a part of an activist project in Iraq, the Iraq Solidarity Project. Now, I'm wondering just maybe if you could expand more on the role and the links and the connections between let's say, social justice movements in North America and movements on the ground in Iraq. Obviously, there's wide opposition to the American occupation, but the situation, I think, really illustrates a connection between the organizing work happening here against the occupation and for justice in Iraq and people on the ground in Iraq who, of course, are rejecting the foreign occupation. How important, from your experiences and everything that has happened recently in the context of these abductions, how important is it to forge these connections more and build more links between social justice movements here and the people on the ground in Iraq?
Well, of course, let's not be under any illusion. The decisions that affect the whole world are taken in the government offices, whether it's in D.C. or in Ottawa or to different levels, of course, and in corporate offices and corporate areas. And that is why the people in Iraq, when they are fighting against the occupation or fighting against any injustice that's happening to them, are fighting, let's call it, fighting an enemy that's very, very much shielded from them, an enemy that sends young kids to execute their orders. And thus, this coordination between what's happening on the ground in a place like Iraq, and I can expand that to many other places in the world as well, and the social justice movement here in North America or in Europe is extremely important, because we could be more effective here in North America to corner the forces that affect the situation on the ground in Baghdad, in Iraq. And it is very important for us to understand what's going on there. It's very important for them to know what work we are trying to do here, not work in two different spheres. It's also very important for us not to assume that we understand their problems and we can speak in their name and offer solutions in their name. It has to be the solutions they want, not hypothetical solutions that we might be thinking of. So let me put it this way. If it wasn't for some of the activists in Baghdad, in this mission I went to in particular, I would have achieved zero. Because it is through our communication before I arrived in Baghdad that the picture was clear. What can I do and what can you do to help me? And we went from there and took it forward to what happened. And of course, that doesn't happen out of void, because if we as activists here in Montreal had no contact with the situation in Iraq, no firsthand dealings with it, we would not have understood how to act. I would not have understood how to, or where to act, or where to go. Mm-hmm. So it is extremely important to continue those, although it is very difficult, because sometimes the people in Iraq would lose hope, and rightly so, would lose hope in what change we can offer. And you mentioned my previous visit to Baghdad in 2003, or to Iraq, because it was a wider visit at the time. And since then, 9 months after the occupation, people would tell me, you are the nth activist to come here and take photos and write and say you're going to write and you're going to do. What's that going to do? We're fed up with that. And I reflect that also to the Palestinians, for example, on the ground, when they see those internationals come and go, and they say at the end, what are you doing? Were you just using us as a photo op, or you think? But we have to believe that there is something, even though small, that we can achieve. And we have to try to make it real for them as well, not sell dreams. It is also very important for us to be there, because within going there, it is much easier to understand the context of reports that come about, opinion polls that are taken on the ground on Iraq, and sometimes how they're biased in the way they are reported. I was back in Amman, Jordan, when this latest opinion poll was released, and I could understand that most of Iraqis would say that they expect the future to be better than the past. Well, they have to have hope. I don't think from the people I talk to that they have a real reason, strong reason to believe that, but they have to have hope in the future, and that's why they would vote in a poll in that way. There are things that are not reported. They also said in the same poll that they think that situation now is worse than it was under Saddam Hussein. That was not reported in the West. That was a part of the same opinion poll, which said that most of them think that the future is going to be better than the past. So it is important from many aspects to continue this link, and becoming more and more difficult every day. I have to say that the existence of foreigners in Iraq is becoming more and more dangerous. It's becoming more and more dangerous to be on the streets of Baghdad, whether you're a foreigner or even an Iraqi or even an undistinguishable face like myself who can be an Iraqi or can be not. So this is getting more and more difficult, and whatever links we can continue to have, we have to try to have, because this is the only alternative to hotel journalism, which is what's happening in Baghdad today, where most of the international journalists cannot go out of their hotels with their own admittance. They don't go out of their hotels. Without mentioning names, one of the Canadian networks wanted to interview me, and they had to ask me which hotel I'm staying in, and before they can answer me whether they can come and interview me or not, they had to check with their security staff whether they can come to that hotel. Is it one of the safe areas or isn't it? But things happen on the street. They don't happen in hotels, and they don't happen in secured hotels in Baghdad. And that's unfortunately what we hear here all the time. Reports from inside hotel lobbies that don't reflect the situation in the street.
Shortly after the CPT activists were abducted in Iraq, Paul Martin called the abductions a, quote, callous act of terror. And since that time, Martin has been making statements publicly saying that the Canadian government is doing all it can to try and negotiate the release or to pressure for the release of these activists who are so clearly standing in opposition to the occupation and the realities of occupation that you just talked about. Now, it seems from what you've described and what was reported in the mainstream media and what has been widely talked about regarding the CPT hostages, that you have achieved a lot more than what could have been achieved or what was achieved by the Canadian government. I know it's probably not possible to compare the two, but maybe talk about those words that Mr. Martin said, callous acts of terror, in reference to the hostage takings, the reaction of the Canadian government, and why you felt it important to launch, let's say, a parallel initiative.
To be honest and to be fair, we don't know. I don't know what the Canadian government is doing. I don't know what efforts they're doing on the ground. It was very important for me to be away from governmental issues because that could right away put in question my credibility in a situation like this, with an abduction like this. So I hope that the Canadian government is doing what it can to help. I hope any entity who can help in any way is doing what it can. Like what you said, I hope that what I did can complement that. I really hope that even if it's a small thing, it helped in a positive direction. But unfortunately, and that's since before I left to Baghdad, I didn't appreciate at all the fact that this was another opportunity by our government to voice big words against international terrorism or against... There were human lives at stake here. And political gains should be put on hold and can wait always when human life is in danger. We needed a positive attitude towards freeing those good people that are held. And we should have focused on that as a government and as a people. And I hope that this didn't harm the situation. You know, sometimes we say that hopefully what happens here in Canada gets reported there on the ground. And some other cases we say we hope that what happens here does not get reported there on the ground, because it can be either it can be either way. So I really think that there are two efforts that should go in parallel. I did not ever look at myself as a negotiator, as was reported about me in some medias. Although I have to be honest, I would have done whatever I could to help in this situation. But I didn't go there as a negotiator. I didn't think that from all the people that could be contacted by the takers of the CPT workers, I would be the one who would be in touch with them. So it's a complicated situation that needs a lot of effort, and we hope that it ends up happily and doesn't matter who broke through. The importance that it gets broken through, and we get a good result, a good final outcome.
You have been listening to an interview with Ihab Lotaif, an Egyptian-Canadian social justice activist who traveled to Iraq in early December 2005 as an envoy of the Canadian Islamic Congress in the context of the kidnapping of four Western activists in Baghdad involved with the Christian
peacemaker teams. The Christian Peacemaker Teams is a social justice organization operating in conflict zones throughout the world, from Colombia to Palestine to Iraq. The CPT focuses on peacemaking, which emphasizes creative public witness, nonviolent direct action, and protection of human rights. In the lead-up to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the CPT established a presence in Baghdad in October 2002, which continued throughout the invasion and until today under the subsequent U.S. military occupation. The CPT's work in Iraq attempts to expose abusive acts by U.S. armed forces and support Iraqis committed to nonviolent resistance against the occupation. This interview detailed Ihab Lotaif's experience traveling to Iraq in early December to hold meetings with Islamic groups in Baghdad and speak publicly to the Arabic media, attesting to the nature of the CPT's anti-occupation work and the mutual trust which exists between the CPT and Muslim organizations in Canada. Lotaif's visit received international media coverage and was also covered widely inside of Iraq, where on December 9th, he held a press conference with the influential Association of Muslim Scholars, appealing for the CPT hostages' release. Until today, the world waits, while continuing to demand and call for the immediate release of the four CPT hostages, whose fate in Iraq remains unknown. For more information on the Christian Peacemaker Teams, visit their website at www.cpt.org. That's www.cpt.org. For detailed information regarding the situation of the kidnapped CPT activists and analysis on the ongoing U.S.-led occupation of Iraq, visit the Electronic Iraq Media Project at www.electronicirak.org.